That, also, is true. That there is death in the spirit land is equally true. But what is death? It is only chance. Flowers change their forms for better ones. The morning sun and the evening shade, 291 though coming from the same source, differ, and no two rays of light issue from the same central source exactly alike. There is a difference in the form and in the action of all things at all times. Nature never makes two precisely alike. Death is vested in sable garments with you. But not so with the disembodied spirit, standing apart from death, and viewing it from the philosophical standpoint, we find it bereft of all shades, and clothed with light. Forms change, old things pass away. All things are perpetually being resurrected. Not only is it here with you in this life, but it continues so to be in the future life, and I doubt not it will so continue throughout the endless future. By Father Henry Fitz-James, June 15, 1869, Question. Do disembodied spirits ever cause mortals to commit suicide? Is the act justified under any circumstances? Answer. Disembodied spirits do often influence mortals in this direction, as in all others. Every act is justified by its parents, by those propelling powers that force it into objective life. This is no exception. All the mistakes that the soul makes in its passage through time must be dearly paid for. No one can atone for them except those who commit them. You call them sins, so they are, because they stand out in the light of evil to your sense. You understand them to be such. All that which does not appeal to your senses right is in that degree evil, a sin. But we call your mistakes results of ignorance. No one will commit suicide if they are, at the time the act is committed, in the possession of a proper amount of knowledge concerning the fate of the suicide. But there are a variety of circumstances that force the weak one to take this choice. Poverty sometimes forces in that direction. Pain. Disease, indeed, all the ills that human life is heir to, may become levers, forcing the intellect in this channel. And the act is of necessity justified by the propelling power of which it was born. But wisdom never justifies any act that is not in harmony with our highest light. When the soul becomes wise, above ignorance, stands apart from it, and beholds the mistakes it has made, in all their deformity, then it is that remorse comes, and the soul receives its due amount of chastisement. Question. As I understand it, the physical form is for the purpose of individualizing spirit. If so, will the time arrive when all unindividualized spirit will thus have become individualized, and consequently there be no necessity for an earthly existence? Answer. Every individual possesses a double individuality, one belonging to the inner and one to the outer life. The latter is the result of physique, education, the former of divine inspiration. They are separate and distinct from each other, although while in the body they hold the closest relationship to each other, yet there is a distinct dividing line ever running between them. Since you are both divine and human, you have need of not only a divine but of a human individuality. One pays allegiance to the things of this human life, and the other pays allegiance to the divine life. And they are perpetually at war with each other, because they are two opposites, and in chemistry when two opposites are brought together there is violent action, opposition. But be it understood that all opposition, in the end, in the finale, results in good, in great good. The very friction that is produced by this opposition is that which elevates the soul and gives it a certain amount of knowledge that it would otherwise be without. Soul, as purely soul, could never be understood. It must come in contact with form in order to express itself. Music would forever remain unheard were there no instruments through which its mystic power could play. Music is in the air, in all things. But it requires proper instruments under the law of music in order that it may demonstrate its presence. So it is with spirit, the soul. There is also a spiritual body through which the inner life can express itself. It holds the same relationship to the soul or the spirit that the body holds to the spirit form. A triune nature have you all, and when one form is laid aside as useless to the spirit, as having fulfilled its mission, done its work, you are not to suppose that the spirit passes out in an unindividualized state, so far as form is concerned, that it has no longer need of form, for this is not so. Nor are you to suppose that your individuality that belonged to the form earthly is carried intact to the spirit world and has form there, for it has not. Question. The last part of the question is, will the time ever arrive when all unindividualized spirit will have become individualized, and see? Answer. No time has been revealed to us wherein such a state of things exists. So long as the earth is capable of producing physical forms, temples through which intelligence can unfold, can come into communication with outer objects in nature, so long they will be produced, in my opinion. Question. Is it not possible that in succeeding ages, both matter and spirit having passed through a refining process, they will again unite and repeat the circle in a greater developed condition? Answer. It is not only possible or probable, but according to the law of chemistry in nature it is a something that must take place. Question. Do you mean to say that these spirits that now occupy forms may at some future stage of life come back and take another, perhaps finer form? Answer. Judging from the experience of others, predicating our faith upon their experience, we are as sure of it as we are of our immortality. Question. I have felt myself that I once inhabited this earth in another form, that I lived far in the east, in India. Whether it is true I cannot say. Answer. It is not at all improbable. In all probability your spirit projects faint glimpses of a prior existence through your present physical senses. But they are so faint, and come to you in such broken fragments, that you can scarcely understand them. Question. I do not understand. I only have a sense of something far off and indistinct that has been in the past. One of the audience. I wish to state that some 40 years ago, in this city, I was conversing with a brother-in-law of mine on this subject, and he said he was positive that he had had an existence prior to this. He is not now living, but if he would come and corroborate that statement it would be very satisfactory to me. Answer. We meet with those who have a similar experience. That which was vague and shadowy in that respect in earthly life becomes clearer and clearer as they pass out of the mists and shadows of the earthly life. Question. Is this common to all humanity? Answer. It is. It belongs alike to everyone. By Reverend Joseph Lowenthal, June 23, 1869. Question. As all things in nature, whether of the mineral, vegetable, or animal kingdom, have a point of commencement, of completeness, and of decay, as regards their individualized forms, will there not also come a time in the far ages of the future, when this our planet, Earth, having brought her productions to their highest possible development, will gradually pass into decay and cease to exist in its present form, its elements being absorbed into other and newer planets? And is not the same true of all systems of worlds in the universe? Answer. Forms are constantly changing their place, and that is not all, they are constantly becoming disintegrated and as constantly taking on new particles, absorbing and giving out. Planets are no exception. The grains of sand under your feet are constantly passing through a variety of changes. Form loses its identity, but the spirit of form does not lose its identity, save that which is allied to form and dependent upon form. Every special kind of life has a distinct mission of its own to perform, and having performed that mission it changes its place, steps out of its orbit, and gives place to something higher. The Earth, like all other planets, has a destiny to fulfill, a certain mission, so far as its earthly career is concerned. Having fulfilled that, it will pass out of its present orbit, enter a spiritual orbit, and will become more etherealized, more spiritualized, than at present, and incapable of sustaining the same kind of life that it sustains at present. Question. Is the use of table stimulants, as tea, coffee, and C, a positive hindrance to the development of mediumship, 296, and especially of clairvoyance? And in what way can a person desiring such development aid its progress? Answer. All such stimulants do not hinder the progress of mediumship, not in the least, but they do sometimes change the character of mediumship. They affect in that way, but they do not hinder the progress of mediumship. Some of the rarest exhibitions of clairvoyance, of spiritual vision, have been given when the clairvoyant was under the influence of some powerful narcotic. It is a well-known fact that the seers and seeresses of olden times were in the habit of visiting certain places where the air, by its peculiar electric condition, would contribute to clairvoyance, to second sight, to the trance, to the changing of speech, and all the various manifestations incident to mediumship. These table stimulants are but children of the same parent. They are but those conditions which under proper states produce those exalted states called mediumship. Used to excess, of course they produce unhappy conditions, and again, as I before remarked, they sometimes change the character of mediumship, but they do not cause the wheels of the car of progress to stand still. Question. In the transition to spirit life, does the spirit enter at once into a healthy, manly condition, or must it go through a process of development before coming to its full stature? Answer. As death, or the change so-called, leaves you, so the spirit world takes you up. Some spirits may become possessed of that entire vigor of manhood or womanhood that is so desirable to mentality, immediately after entering the spirit world. Others remain in a dormant state, incapable of action to any great extent for a long time. This was at page 297. Question. Is there any condition in this present life where people can live free from sin? Answer. That depends upon how you define the term sin. All growth involves mistakes. So long as individualities grow, so long they are liable to make mistakes. Those mistakes you call sins. Perfection, if such a state can ever be attained, shuts out all sin. But I know of no one who has ever attained that state of perfection that church people so earnestly pray for. Not in this life can it be found, and I have not found it as yet in the spirit life. Question. Is there any standard of right and wrong in the spirit life? Answer. No, none whatever, save those standards that are erected in every living soul. Each one has a standard for themselves, and no one can borrow of another. Question. Are clairvoyants always controlled by individual spirits? Answer. No, certainly not. There is what is termed independent clairvoyance, a state wherein the clairvoyant becomes suddenly thrown into a condition whereby the past is revealed, and the future, together with the present, without the intervention of any second intelligence. Question. By what power are they drawn into it? Answer. By the action of natural law that is found in the physical form, and that finds a correspondence in all its surroundings. Clairvoyance is dependent for agents upon all that by which it is surrounded, even that is called independent clairvoyance, which does not need the aid of any foreign intelligence. You sometimes wander apart from the body in sleep without the aid of any foreign spirit. You are clairvoyant then. You take cognizance of things passing perhaps in other lands, perhaps in the spirit world. You receive visions of the to come, you receive pictures of that which is past, and the living reality of that which is present, all through independent clairvoyance. But this same independent clairvoyance is dependent upon the soil, upon the electrical and magnetic currents by which the subject is surrounded, and by these conditions, but not by the intervention of any outside spirit. By Cardinal Chevreuse, June 22, 1869. Question. It is said that the spiritual body possesses all the organs of the physical body, and that there is nothing without use. If this be the case, of what use to the spirit are the teeth and stomach? Do spirits eat food, masticating and digesting it, and passing it out of the system in the spirit world as we do in this? If not, of what use are the internal organs? Answer. The spirit body possesses all the organs known to the natural body, and all the attributes, all the functions, known to the natural body, and more also, for at each successive step in progress the spirit has need of new functions, new attributes, and the divine providence provides for all it hath need of. Yes, the spirit has a stomach, has teeth, and uses them. Spirits have need to eat, as you have. They do not subsist upon nothing. Here you are in the rudimental state of spirit life, and here you eat. The spirits dwell in a more refined state, but that they eat also. Receive and give is in the order of nature, divine and human. Therefore, all the processes by which progress is carried on here, are known also and made use of in the spirit world. Question. Is the spirit body a perfect type of the natural physical body? When the latter is deformed, will the deformity appear in the spiritual body after death? Answer. Those deformities that are the result of accident, so called by you, will not appear upon the spirit body, for it can suffer no accident. That deformity that appears upon the body that is outworked from the inner forces will appear also upon the spirit body. Question. Can the spirit detach itself from the spiritual body? Answer. Yes, but as spirit is always dependent upon form as a mode of expression, it can only detach itself from one spirit body to become attached to another. Question. Can we change these forms at will? Answer. Yes, under proper circumstances, but under circumstances requisite to the case. You can commit suicide here if you are only furnished with proper conditions, and it is the same yonder. Question. In reference to the previous question I would ask, suppose a person is born with native deformities, are these seen in the spirit? Answer. They are seen upon the spirit form, and remain there till that form passes beyond them in growth. Question. Then the spirit will of necessity make itself apparent in that form in returning to earth through mediums? It might be recognized clairvoyantly by those deformities? Answer. Yes, certainly, as by the color of the hair, the eyes, the skin, the size, the temperament. All these are results of the projecting power of spirit through matter, therefore they appear upon the spirit body as upon the natural body. But if by accident, by violence, a limb of the natural body is lost or disfigured, or any portion of the body is disfigured, that is not seen upon the spirit body, for it comes from the external, and belongs to the external. The Negro is the Negro still in the spirit world, 300 the Indian is the Indian still. And why? Because he has been made such by the action of the inner or spiritual forces upon the outer or natural forces. Question. Is spirit power communicated to physical bodies through electricity as a medium? Or by what means are they enabled to move chairs, tables, or other material bodies? Answer. Electricity is the most powerful agent we know, under the direction of spirit. It is by that power that all tangible bodies are moved, all the so-called miracles are performed. Question. Does this account for the power of healing by electricity? Answer. Yes, I believe the terms magnetism and electricity are synonymous, they are only different terms of one power. It is a subtle force, in the hands of intelligence and under the direction of intelligence, that becomes all-powerful everywhere. Question. Is the medium of necessity gifted with more of the positive force than of the negative or recipient? Answer. No. Sometimes the more negative the medium or subject, the greater the power that can be exercised through them, for it so happens that nearly all your cures performed by your healers, either modern or ancient, are performed by the intervention of spirit, perhaps many spirits. The material form is but the tunnel through which the power is poured. It is that instrument that causes the forces to come to a focus, that thereby they may be centered upon the one to be healed. Sometimes there are persons found who are so largely gifted in their own natural bodies that they can perform very strange and wonderful cures aside from the intervention of any other spirit. This was at page 301. By Cardinal Chevreuse, June 24, 1869. Question. If, upon leaving the body, the spirit gravitates to a congenial sphere, how can it be unhappy? Or, in other words, how can you reconcile congeniality with unhappiness? Answer. I do not understand that spirits at death are ushered immediately into a congenial sphere. I do understand that they may gravitate, each one to their own proper sphere, whatever or wherever it may be. No one can occupy the sphere belonging to another. It is congenial to their needs, to their state, but not to their desires, therefore it does not provoke happiness. The second state of existence, or that which is so understood to be by you, is a very natural state, devoid of all the lines of castes and creeds and conventionalities of this state. Here, people, by virtue of the needs of this life, dwell in states that do not belong to them spiritually. It is not so in the other life. Gold cannot buy place or position. Wealth that is recognized to be such by the soul, purchases only for the soul that the soul is ready to receive, nothing more. By Cardinal Chevreuse, June 28, 1869. Question. How do spirits obtain the food they use? What equivalent do they give for it? Do they work for it as we do here? And, if so, are they subject to the terrible reverses humanity experiences upon this earth on that account? Answer. It is said that it is the order of nature, in physical life, to obtain bread by the sweat of the brow, by toil, by exertion, and we may add further that to obtain anything that ministers either to our pleasures or our needs. We must exert ourselves, we must toil, we must labor. There is a kind of labor that belongs especially to the physical body, the physical, organic life, and there is another kind of labor which belongs to spiritual life. This kind is desire, ardent, earnest desire. You know very well what the kind that belongs to physical life is. You are not unacquainted with the toil of the hands, of the feet, the exerting of the members of the body to obtain what is necessary to sustain the body. But you are not so well acquainted with that which belongs more especially to the spirit, although you have sat, many, perhaps all of you, in the primary school of that spirit labor, yet you have hardly crossed the threshold. Yes, spirits do labor to obtain what is necessary for them to have. They labor by earnest desire, but they do not meet with those terrible reverses that are met with here. The soul's needs in the soul world stand out prominent and clear, and they demand a supply. And as the Great Father Spirit has furnished an adequate supply for every want, no desire can have a fruitless birth. It must draw to itself that which the soul has need of. A very large class or group of spirits, who are as yet magnetically attached to the earth and earthly conditions, obtain much of their sustenance through the action of human life, through the magnetic conditions that belong partly to human life, or stand as agents between this world and the world of souls. This subtle element called magnetism is the agent in the hands of whoso can understand it, and a very powerful agent it is, too. Poverty is known to the spirit after death, but not that kind of poverty that is experienced here. The soul can possess itself at will of all that is necessary for its good, for its advancement, for its unfoldment. The law of mine and thine is done away within the spirit world. Let us thank the Great Father for that. No soul can hug to its bosom any more of God's gifts than it has need of. No one can have more of the beauty of the spirit world than it can well appropriate. Therefore you see there is enough for all. Question. Am I right in believing that the body serves to develop the spirit or spirit body, and, having answered its purpose, fades and dies? The spirit body, having attained its maturity, remains firm, not sharing in the slightest degree in the decay of the material body, and presenting the same appearance when the man dies at the age of 90 that it would if he had died at 35 or 40? Answer. Your correspondent is very nearly correct. The spirit body is indeed, to a very great extent, a production of the physical body and physical, magnetic life. And that spirit body is not always matured here in this life. The infant possesses the spirit body of the infant, and that spirit body matures after death, perhaps just as well as before that change. Question. Do the souls of men and women essentially differ, independently of the conditions that surround their bodies? Answer. Not as souls, in essence they are one, but in the manifestation that accrues from the essence they are more than one. Question. What is the difference between spirit and animal magnetism? Answer. The difference is in degree. One is more refined than the other. Animal magnetism is that is adapted to animal life, more crude, more dense than that adapted to spirit life. In essence they are one. They differ only in degree. This was at page 304. Question. Is the power emanating from healers of the sick this spirit power, or is it blended with physical power? Answer. It is sometimes pure spirit power, at other times it is pure animal power, at other times it is a blending of the two. By Theodore Parker, June 29, 1869. Question. It has been stated through the medium, on different occasions, by various parties, that a spirit is constantly developing, rising to higher life, and that the spiritual body is constantly putting on changes to correspond to this development. Now, in my mind, there is an antagonism between this statement and the statement that spirits do, or will in time to come, return to and re-inhabit the earth, in mortal bodies. Viewed from my standpoint, the return of a spirit to and re-inhabiting the earth in a mortal body, is retrogression, not progression. From the second statement it would seem as though a person, after toiling to the top round, or thereabouts, of the spiritual ladder, was compelled to go to the bottom and remount. Will you please explain the apparent antagonism between the two statements? Answer. The antagonism consists in your ignorance of the law, and of the true definition of the term progression. It is not simply a straightforward, onward and upward course, by no means. But it implies change, and all change takes place in cycles or circles. This is the order of nature, both human and divine. The germ progresses spirally, and what is true of the germ is true of mature life, so called. You go up on the mountaintop, you descend into the valley that you may ascend upon the next mountaintop. You seem to think that progression is attended by an even, uninterrupted sphere of action. It is not so. There are different tones in the great scale of human progression, some are low and some are high. Because you have touched once upon the low notes, you are not to suppose you are never to touch them again, by no means. Because you have known what human misery is once, you are not to suppose you are never to know it again. Though you ascend into the highest heaven, you are not to suppose you may not descend again to the lowest hell. Take for example the man Christ, who was said to be the special Son of God. All Christianity so believes. Some consider him equal with the Father. If this be true, and if the record concerning his life be true also, surely you are not to expect any more than he had during his natural and divine life. He descended into the valley and shadow of death with all his godliness and with all his divine life, and, more than this, he mingled with publicans and sinners. In the Garden of Gethsemane he sweat great drops of blood in his agony, and cried in his human weakness, "If it be thy will, let the cup pass from me, nevertheless, let thy will, not mine, be done." And upon the cross he cried, "O my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" This was progression in its divinest and truest sense. Jesus lost nothing of his godliness, nothing of his divinity, nothing that belonged to him as a superior being when he descended into these deep valleys of human misery. Shall we say that he ceased to progress then? That would be a libel upon God and upon human nature, for progression is unceasing, eternal, never stops. If Jesus, the pattern of the divine life, such to the Christian world at least, could go down into the valley to progress, you must not expect anything better. It is life ever the same.